Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Meenakshi Jiji Durham, Associate Professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa, and author of The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It, which is also the topic of her lecture. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, November 8, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Jeffrey Spencer, Assistant Professor of Art at the College of St. Mary.
Dr. Durham is the author of our common text this year, The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. She is a professor of journalism at the University of Iowa, where she teaches classes in gender and media, critical theories of the media, and magazine writing. Dr. Durham's work centers on the media and the politics of the body with an emphasis on gender, sexuality, race, and youth cultures. After her lecture, there will be time for questions, and there will be a book signing at the bookstore, and you're all welcome. It goes from approximately 2 to 2:45. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Jiji Durham.
Will you give me the high sign when it's getting time to stop? Okay. Will you give me some kind of signal when it's time to stop?
I'm going to step out from behind this podium. Thank you so much for inviting me here. I always sort of welcome the opportunity to talk with like-minded women and a few men about the topic of my research. And I'm really honored that you've chose my book as the common reading selection at the College of St. Mary. I'm so flattered and honored by that. Thank you very much. I just want to begin by saying that I'm a pro-sex feminist. And I define that as meaning that I think sex is a normal, healthy, natural part of growing up. And I think we actually tend to be far too squeamish about discussions of sexuality. And we ought to be sort of, you know, less troubled about talking about these things. That's the starting point for discussing the ideas that I offer in my recent book, which I'm here to talk about today. As you know, my book is called The Lolita Effect. The title is a reference to Lolita, who was the 12-year-old protagonist of the eponymous 1958 Vladimir Nabokov novel. In the book, the child is seduced, sexually used, and practically enslaved by her stepfather. But the book is written with such guile and wit that you actually, when you're reading it, the reader finds himself or herself sympathizing with the pedophile. If you really think about Lolita, though, you realize that the child was the victim in this novel, as any child in such a circumstance would be. But that's not the way we talk about her. Lolita, in popular culture, has become our code word for a little girl or a teenager who is precociously sexy, who seduces older men, who is inappropriate in the way that she presents herself. She's too sexy, too soon, in the words of Jean Kilborn and Diane Levin, who have also written about this subject. We tend to condemn Lolitas. We see them as the problem instead of turning our attention to a culture that's producing them. Not, again, that I think that sex is a taboo subject, or that children need to be shielded from any understanding of sexuality. In fact, I believe that sex is not only a natural, normal part of growing up and being human, but it is, a natural part of just developing, of development, of human development. I think children deserve accurate, factual, age-appropriate information about sex at different points during their lives, and that such information should be geared to helping them to reach maturity and make good decisions for themselves as adults. But that is not what they're getting in today's media-saturated environment, which the research shows that they turn to for their information about sex far more than they turn to their peers, their parents, or their teachers. I've spent more than a decade now analyzing representations and messages about sexuality in the mainstream commercial media, especially in media targeted to children and adolescents. I want to mention that I've done a number of analyses of media, and I've also done ethnographic work with teenagers going into middle schools to talk to them in their peer group settings about how they're handling all of this. What I've found is that rather than being a source of accurate, useful, thoughtful information about sex, the media is a font of distorted, unrealistic, and even damaging notions about sex that are not in kids' best interests, and especially not in girls' best interests. Several studies show that sexual content in media aimed at children is rising. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation study found that over the past 20 years, there has been an overall increase in the number of portrayals and the amount of talk about about sex in these media and an increase in the explicitness of these portrayals. This is not necessarily bad in and of itself, but the research also shows that less than 0.5% of this content is about healthy sexual practices or about sexual health at all. And research also shows, again, as I've said, that kids rely on these media for their sexual information, turning to it far more than they turn to parents, teachers, or even their peers for their information. What they're basically getting from the media is not helpful. I've identified the most common myths. There are 5 of them in my book, and I'll discuss each one of them during this talk today. But before I do, I want to address the term that I use in the title, sexualization. The subtitle of the book is The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. This is a term that was used by the American Psychological Association in a task force report from 2007. And they define sexualization as objectifying, degrading, sexist, or otherwise inaccurate and harmful representations of sexuality. So sexualization is vastly different from a healthy concept of sexuality. That might be accurate, progressive, helpful. So I'm not saying that all sexual representation is wrong or bad. I'm saying that there are particular ways in which sexuality is being represented that conforms to that definition of sexualization that is objectifying and harmful. So the myths that I've identified in the book are actually myths of sexualization, and they work because they've become accepted as real in our society. In this way, I'm using the term myth, as Roland Barthes did, to describe a rhetorical figure that has become naturalized and works in the world as if it were real until a myth analyst comes along to, deconstruct and analyze it and reveal the fact that it's not based in any kind of truth at all. So these are myths that circulate, but we don't recognize them as myths because they've become so entrenched in our popular culture and in our consciousness that we actually tend to believe them. So, as I said, there are 5 basic myths of girls' sexuality. That comprise the Lolita effect. And I'm going to go through each one. So myth number 1 is, if you've got it, flaunt it. And there are, of course, 2 parts to this myth. The first is the condition that a girl needs to have it. And then if she does, she must signal her sexuality by flaunting it, usually by baring as much of her body as possible. Now, I don't think bodies are bad or shameful, and I don't think we need to be, hiding or swaddling our bodies from head to foot as they did in Victorian times. I think bodies are great and that there's no need to treat them as if they were some kind of shameful secret. But I think the problem is that in the media, desirability is always linked to female body display, and exhibitionism is portrayed as somehow being empowering and good, daring. To me, that's a pretty narrow definition of something as complex as sexuality and desire, and there are problems with the simple equation of exhibitionism with power. In these representations, I think sex is defined via a very unequal power relationship in which girls are the object of male viewing pleasure. And we talked a little bit about this in the classes that I went to this morning. So in this construction, boys are supposed to arbitrate and judge girls' desirability based on purely physical criteria dictated by the media and marketing machines. There's no mutuality at work here, no equity in the relationship. Girls don't gaze at boys' bodies in the same ways that boys gaze at girls, or at least not in the media. I think in real life, girls are active lookers as well, but you don't see that being portrayed. And if you've noticed, boys' fashions are getting more and more covered up with the big baggy jeans and the big sweatshirts and the big hoods and everything like that. So boys are, being encouraged to conceal their bodies and to, be able to judge girls from a position of relative strength and power where they're not on display. And girls' fashions are becoming, more and more revealing. And not only are they being encouraged to display more and more skin, but the fashions are more and more connected with actually prostitution and forms of sex work. The corsets, the thongs, the fishnet hose, like that image I showed right in the beginning of the girls with the birthday card for the toddler with this, the Bratz figure in the stiletto heels and the fishnets and the short skirt and everything. And it's just a little bit, it's moving towards a different sort of depiction. Girls are being bombarded with this idea that this constitutes girl power, when in fact it actually constitutes quite the opposite. It's putting girls on display for the male gaze. The media also tells girls over and over that what really matters is to be hot. So, 405 ways to look hot at every party, dress like a celebrity, make your crush want you, right? Get sexy eyes and all this. And so, all they're talking about is, how girls can present themselves in terms of hotness, which implies that everything else is secondary. You know, there's no value, it appears, in any other qualities whatsoever. No other traits are being presented here. You know, intelligence or artistic ability or scientific aptitude, mathematical aptitude, spirituality, some sense of, you know, community spirit, environmental activism, nothing, nothing. None of that is ever, you know, on the cover of a 17 magazine. It's only and always about hotness, you know, hot, 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 as if there's no other aspect to a girl, nothing else that matters. So the ideal media girl is one-dimensional. Only her hotness matters, which is really limiting girls from developing their multiple potentials and becoming fully realized human beings. And that hotness, of course, depends on the second part of the myth, which is if you've got it. And if you've got it usually means having the anatomy of some kind of a sex goddess, right? Which is the thin yet voluptuous body. If a Barbie doll were translated to human proportions, she would be a 5'9" woman with an 18-inch waist, 36-inch breasts, and 33-inch hips, and she would weigh 110 pounds. That's too skinny to stand upright. That's too skinny to menstruate. That's too skinny to be a normal human being. Many medical analyses of these proportions have actually revealed this. Yet, that is the body that young girls are encouraged to have, to acquire. It's the body of all the Disney princesses, all the models in catalogs, all the actresses in teen television shows and films, all the idealized pop singers. So it's not surprising that on Facebook and MySpace, young girls are, you know, asking each other about diet pills and laxatives that will help them lose dramatic amounts of weight, nor that 90% of all eating disorders are experienced by girls and young women, nor that the number of teenage girls getting plastic surgery has tripled in the past 10 years. And in fact, the Barbie body is pretty much unattainable for girls without borderline starvation and extensive plastic surgery. Bodies like that are not found in nature. You cannot at the same time be extremely thin and be extremely voluptuous. It just doesn't happen. If you lose that amount of weight, if you're 5'10" or 5'9" and you weigh 110 pounds, then you're thin all over. You're not going to have gigantic breasts. It's just not, you know, it's not something that normally happens. So it has to be, that body has to be constructed artificially. There's no other way to get it. And that actually brings me to one of the main points I want to make about all this. The Barbie body is not a social or cultural body. It's not a socially idealized body. It's a commercially profitable body because attaining it calls for vast amounts of consumerism, the consumption of diet aids, you know, pills, plastic surgeries, cosmetics, body-slimming undergarments like Spanx and this and that, that kind of, you know, flatten your tummy and pinch in your bulges and all this kind of stuff. Skin treatments, fashion, including high-heeled shoes to elongate the legs, and on and on and on. So this is a body that generates tremendous amounts of profits because it takes so much consumption to be able to try to acquire it. The ideal body has to be unattainable, and audiences have to be made to believe that it can be attained through consumption in order to sustain the multi-billion dollar industries that depend on this dynamic. So the fashion industry, the diet industries, the, you know, fitness center industries, the cosmetics industry, I mean, these are all multi-billion dollar enterprises, and they would collapse if people didn't believe that consuming these in, you know, in sort of insatiable proportions would lead to the attainment of this kind of a Barbie body. One of the things that I think we all need to understand is a little bit about what's called the political economy of the media, which is how the media generate their funding. The media, almost all media, and depend almost entirely on advertising for their revenues. It's not subscriptions that pay their bills. So, you know, you'll see sort of magazine subscriptions that say, you know, get 24 issues for $12 or something like that. And it's not the $12 that you pay to subscribe that's generating the billions of dollars in profit that they make. It's the advertising. In the same way, sitting down and, you know, clicking on a website or watching television is free. You're not actually paying anything to do it. So all of their money is coming from their advertising revenues, and these are tremendous. And just to give you a few, just to give you a sense of what it is, 17 magazine earned $101.9 million in ad revenue in 2004, while the online Teen People had $77 million. Online advertising in 2009 totaled $6.3 billion. So this is where the money actually comes from. So everything about the ways the bodies are presented in the media have to do with generating profits, and I think it's very important to understand that. The third myth is the one that I call pretty babies. And to me, this is the most troubling, the most disturbing of all the myths. It's the insistent idea that the younger a girl is, the sexier she is. In a way, this is not a new idea, though. This is a new idea, but it has just a few precedents. Some of you may be old enough to remember the 14-year-old Brooke Shields in the 1970s selling Calvin Klein jeans. You know, nothing comes between me and my Calvins. But she was an anomaly. Today, very young models are used in most advertising and marketing campaigns. The reason Brooke Shields got so much attention in the 70s was that nobody had used a 14-year-old in that sort of sexy way before. But now, it's commonplace. Most of the models that we see in marketing and advertising are very young. Models tend to start at around 12 or 13 years old these days. And they appear in media targeted to teens and preteens, as well as media targeted to adults, which I find also quite troubling. So you see them in these highly eroticized and provocative kind of outfits and presentations. And you know, it's not just teens who are getting this message, it's adults as well, like that image of the girl in the Vanity Fair magazine that I showed you. I mean, it's not children who are reading Vanity Fair, it's adults who read Vanity Fair, and so they're seeing this 11-year-old being presented as a legitimate object of sexual desire. So it's telling adults that young adolescent girls, and sometimes even preteen girls, are both legitimate objects of sexual desire and fully capable sexual actors, because she is made up to look older than she really is, and the idea is that she could participate in sexual activity freely, but she, you know, really, if you look at her body, she's 10 or 11 years old, and that really shouldn't be happening. There's a kind of a problem there. Because neither of those things are true. Girls at 12 and 13 or 10 or 11 or whatever, they're not cognitively or emotionally or psychologically or sometimes even physically capable of, you know, being involved in sexual activity, in a way where they're in control of their that activity. They're too young to understand the risks and the rights and the responsibilities that go along with being sexual. But they're being presented in the media as fully fledged sexual actors. So again, we're getting this message that it's okay for little girls to be in these positions. Now, this is very different from the way things were in the past. In the 1950s, Marilyn Monroe was 29 when she was in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So she was pushing 30. She was an adult woman with an adult woman's body. Sophia Loren was 23 in Desire Under the Elm. So we have not seen little girls being presented as sex objects in earlier eras. This is sort of a new thing that's going on now. I think focusing on very young girls as the ideal sexual beings is a dangerous trend in light of the very high rates of child sexual abuse that occur in this country and around the world, and also in light of the proliferation of the multi-billion dollar child prostitution and pornography industries, which UNICEF estimates involves 1.2 million children worldwide and generates over $12 billion a year. So we're seeing children being sort of sexually exploited and victimized. I think the mainstream media are, in a sense, contributing to this. Again, they're giving us the impression that it's okay for children to be in these sorts of situations and presented in these ways. I think it's also giving grown women a very damaging message, which is that in order to be sexually desirable, in order to be sexy, that you somehow have to embody an adolescent or even pre-adolescent body. So it's telling grown women that they have to have, you know, the tiny little hips and bodies of 11-year-olds in order to be sexually desirable, which is just, you know, ridiculous. And it's impossible for someone who's 30 or 40 or 50. And we need to be asking ourselves why it is in this moment that, you know, juvenility is being emphasized as a criterion for ideal sexuality, and why grown women are being replaced by little girls in this arena. It should be the opposite. It should be, you know, if we're going to think about, you know, potent female sexuality, that's the realm of adulthood, not the realm of pre-adolescence. And so that's a question I'd like to get back to later. The fourth myth is that violence is sexy. And that's another one that I'm, you know, very, very troubled about. I've examined in the book the sort of increasing linkage of sex with violence, usually perpetrated by boys or men against girls. This is, of course, a very real problem in our society. We have high levels of domestic violence, and so this issue should be discussed and represented. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be in the media. But in a great deal of commercial media, it's not represented as a serious problem at all. It's glorified. It's exalted. It's presented as something that's kind of wonderful. In slasher films, for example, like the Hostel series or the Saw series of films, there are a lot, and also in violent video games, like the notorious Grand Theft Auto series, graphic violence is connected with male arousal. Women or girls are in revealing outfits or sexual situations that are sort of designed to arouse your average heterosexual male viewer. And just when the killer strikes in a slasher movie, you know, it's usually when the girls are in some sort of state of undress or some kind of sex is about to happen, that's when the killer sort of launches and all the blood starts to splatter. So it's always set up so that violence is linked with sexuality, especially with female sexuality and male arousal. These two things are, you know, connected at a sort of ideological level in these films. So just when the male viewers are the most aroused, that's when the violence tends to happen. For adolescent and younger boys, this is a powerful developmental message that violence is sexy. In video games, too, women frequently appear as sex workers, right, as prostitutes, as go-go dancers, as pole dancers, whatever, as if there aren't any other professions for women. But, you know, that's what you have in video games. And then there's a lot of, again, their bodies are juxtaposed with violence. And the violence isn't always directed against them, although in many cases it is. But still, there's that linkage of sort of male arousal and violence that keeps on, you know, happening in these kinds of media. Although these games are rated, studies show that most young teenage boys have played games rated for mature audiences and seen films with R or NC-17 ratings. So very, very young boys are playing these games. And a lot of these games are so deeply interactive that when you're in that first-person situation, you're the one that's perpetrating the violence against these women, and often you score points for them. So again, in real life, we're seeing rising rates of teen dating violence in this country. It's difficult to prove causality, of course. It's not that everybody who watches or plays a game like this immediately runs out and rapes somebody. But, you know, what it is, you know, we have to ask if the overt celebration of sexual violence in the media is helping or hurting girls, you know, and what sort of an ideological environment it's creating in terms of our acceptance of sexual violence and other violence against women. So I think we really have to ask these questions about what, you know, what sort of climate it's creating for women and girls right now. The fifth myth is called what boys like. So in most of the media that I analyze that's targeted to young girls, sexuality is constructed in terms of pleasing boys. That is, attracting the male gaze, figuring out how to get him to crush on a girl, and so on. There's never any discussion of girls' own pleasure, agency, or comfort, you know, comfort zones. And again, I'm just going to go back to some of these magazines that I showed you before. Okay, so like this one, right, Teen Magazine. The whole cover is, look at the top, what boys really want, 8 secrets you need to know, how to get him to crush on you, you know, be the girl everyone loves, and so on. But there's always like this invisible male that's, you know, that's sort of in the picture and what you really have to be thinking about. And it's the same one thing here, you know, 405 ways to look hot, make your crush want you, you know, get sexy eyes and so forth. So really it's all about kind of attracting boys and, you know, pleasing boys and, you know, presenting yourself so that you are the object of, you know, the male gaze, you know, and male desirability. And there's really no emphasis. You never see magazines like this that say, you know, what girls really want, you know, how what boys should do to please girls, right? I mean, it's never turned the other way. It's always about girls pleasing boys. And there are no magazines for boys that, you know, that say things like, you know, how to get her to, you know, to like you or whatever. It doesn't go the other way. And there's, you know, and also there's not a representation of sort of an ethical or equitable sexual relationship where both people are sort of mutually, you know, trying to achieve some kind of, you know, pleasurable and happy balance with each other. What we find all then from the research as a result is that girls often don't know how to deal with sexual situations. They don't know how to set boundaries when they're in actual sexual situations to say, you know, this far and no further. They don't know things about like where to get contraception or even how to insist on its use during a sexual relationship or you know, how to set certain kinds of boundaries if they're in those situations. And this, I think, is problematic because if you stop to look at the figures, the statistics, in the U.S., we have the highest rate of teen pregnancy in the industrialized world. It's twice as high as the UK, 4 times as high as France and Germany, 8 times as high as Japan, and, you know, off the chart in comparison to Scandinavian countries that have very, very low levels of teen pregnancy. It's the same with sexually transmitted infections among teens. Centers for Disease Control study a few years ago, 2 years ago, I think, showed that 1 in 4 teen girls in the U.S. has a sexually transmitted infection. 1 in 4, 25%. That's incredibly high, and they only looked at 13 to 19-year-old girls. I think if they'd gone a little younger, they would have found the numbers to be even higher. So, you know, we're not doing that well in terms of helping girls to make good decisions about their own sexual lives, right? To protect themselves and to take control of their own lives. And I think, in part, we need to be looking at these types of media. Could it be, you know, that this is all happening because girls are never given any guidance on how to handle sexuality in practical, sensible, and ultimately responsible ways, and that girls are never given a sense that they have their own rights in a sexual relationship, that they have both rights and responsibilities that they can take charge of. But we don't get that from these kinds of media. These media circulate globally as well as within the United States. In an era of transnational media, we're seeing these myths of sexuality penetrate cultures that had different understandings and approaches to gender and sexuality, some of which were far more progressive and diverse than those contained in these myths. The ideal of the Barbie body is displacing other cultures' notions of what constitutes beauty. The hookup culture of sexuality is displacing more considered and self-directed decisions about having sex. Just an example, and if you've read the book, you know this, but in other countries, for example, in Brazil, the ideal of beauty, of female beauty at one time, was what they called a pear-shaped body with smaller breasts and larger hips, and that's being replaced now with the other type of, you know, the large breasts and thin hips. They're getting plastic surgeries to try to achieve that look. In Japan, it was a more, you know, certainly a less voluptuous aesthetic that was considered to be more ideal, you know, a more slender body, and that's changing. As I talk about in the book, women of color are being encouraged more and more to adopt more Caucasian standards of beauty. So bleaching creams are being sold in many countries in Africa and Asia so that women are trying to get lighter skin. The most popular form of plastic surgery in the Far East is eyelid surgery so that Asian women can get the more Caucasian-looking double eyelid. So not only is it circulating Western standards of beauty, but there's also a racial hierarchy involved where Caucasian norms are being presented as the ideal, and women of color are being devalued in terms of the, you know, diversity of the appearance that they might be able to present. So we're getting this really homogenized notion of what constitutes beauty, and also we're getting ideas about sexuality and that are displacing other cultures' approaches to it. So the cultural collisions that are being caused by these myths in the global mediascape are sometimes putting girls in very dangerous and vulnerable positions. We've also heard of honor killings in certain Middle Eastern countries and Asian countries because girls are trying to adopt Western modes of fashion. Not that I'm criticizing the girls for this at all, but it's just that it's causing consequences that, you know, people, I think the media industries in particular, are not thinking about as they circulate these kinds of images. So we need to be aware that these myths are not just harming our own daughters and kids in this country, but they're sort of wreaking havoc with girls worldwide. So, what can we do about all this? So, I could be the kind of academic that just wrote this book and said, okay, I've identified all the problems and now you deal with it. And I'll just go back to my little ivory tower and I'll write another book, which I'm actually doing. But I also wanted to come up with some really proactive solutions to some of this stuff. What can we do? And I think there are effective real-world ways to counter the myths and enable girls to be critical, proactive media consumers who can make good decisions about their sexual lives. So here are just a few of the things that I suggest in the book. One of the things I do, of course, is to urge parents to talk to girls about this. I think before these conversations can happen, though, the caring adults in the world need to become familiar with the tools of media analysis, and that's a key point in my book as well. Because as adults, I think we all need to understand and recognize the myths and their manifestations in order to be able to challenge them and work on helping children recognize and resist them as well. So maintaining open channels of communication about the media, sexuality, and myth, I think, is crucial. So each chapter of the book is sort of directed towards helping the adults that I wrote the book for recognize the forms of these myths and kind of think about how they're coming across. Sometimes when I talk to audiences, you know, people haven't ever thought about the fact that there's always this invisible he on every magazine cover, you know, what you can do to please him, what boys like. I mean, you know, that you sort of have to start, you know, it takes a minute to step back and realize that that's really a pervasive kind of myth. In the same way, this there's a lot of talk about body image and so on, but I think we really need to recognize the fact that the bodies that are being presented as sexually ideal are really, really unrealistic, unattainable, and commercially driven constructions of female sexuality that have nothing to do with the real world sort of diversity and beauty that we see all around us every day. So the second thing, of course, is that you have to maintain open channels of communication, and this has to be done in a sort of friendly, calm, you know, kind of responsive sort of way. I think lecturing kids is usually the kiss of death. You know, if you say, you know, you're leaving the house dressed like that over my dead body, then, you know, that's not going to get anywhere. All it causes is conflict, and, you know, it's not helpful in terms of... So I think having sort of friendlier conversations, respectful conversations, you know, listening to kids' points of view as well as offering your own opinions and having a lot of give and take about this stuff is really the best way to go. I started very early, and I think these conversations do need to start very early, before the stakes become, you know, as high as they are when kids start to think about entering into sexual relationships and so on. So I have two daughters of my own, and I started when they were really little. And we didn't talk about sex, but when they were like 2 years old, we would be, if we saw a commercial for some kind of sugary cereal, I would say, you know, why do you think they're telling us that cereal is so healthy when we know it's bad for us? And, you know, they would start thinking about, well, why are they trying to get us to eat this, you know, this pile of sugar and telling us that it's, you know, it's nutritious? So they could start to have a little bit of a critical consciousness and, you know, think about, even though they might not be able to articulate it, the profit motives behind advertising, right? And then when they were a little bit older, if we were watching a Disney movie, I'd say, wow, do you really think anybody could stand up on legs that skinny? Or do you really think Ariel could breathe with a waist that thin? And they would look at these, you know, these Disney princesses, and they'd start laughing. And they'd go, oh, no, nobody can breathe if they're that skinny, right, if their waist is that little. And so they would start to make a distinction between fact and fiction, and they could see that these are cartoon bodies and that real people don't have bodies like that. And they would laugh at them. And derisive laughter is a great tool of resistance, you know. So, you know, you can start it when they're little, and then when they get older, you know, you've already got that conversation going, so you can start talking about the Louis Vuitton ad or, you know, Miley Cyrus pole dancing, and those are the kinds of things you can talk about, you know, later. So I think, you know, starting conversations that help children become critical consumers is very effective, and these can start, you know, very, very early. The problem, of course, is that, you know, what I found is that most kids are natural critics, you know, that children and girls have noticed a lot of these things for themselves. And once you kind of, you know, open the door for them to start talking about it, you know, you can unleash all of this really great critical analysis, but they've never been given the space to do this, because if no one ever allows them to talk back, then they get the sense that they have to accept what the media is telling them without, you know, without any kind of response to it. So I think parents can encourage girls to be active media, you know, consumers in these ways, and schools can and counselors can. I think there are a lot of different settings in which these kinds of conversations can happen, and it really helps to open up those kinds of critical spaces. I think another thing that parents can do is to encourage girls to be to be media creators themselves, because again, girls are wonderfully imaginative and you know, sort of vital, and when they produce their own media, often you see narratives that are different from the ones that are being given to them by the corporate media. So, like my own daughter, when she was about 10, she wrote a little movie script and she shot a video with our video camera starring her friends. And, you know, it was a bunch of different kids sort of living their lives in a way that she found to be, you know, fun and interesting. And it was different. It was not just sort of copying what she might have seen in the media. So I think, you know, one of the other things that does is it shows kids that the media are a construction. And that if corporate media construct these things one way, then other people can construct them another way, right? And they can also do that through other forms of creativity, you know, writing, blogging, you know, photography, whatever they want to do. I think it's important to sort of inspire that creativity in them that might construct different versions of what girls' lives are all about. I should mention at this point that I'm not pro-censorship. I think, you know, free speech is important, and censorship would be a slippery slope. On the contrary, I believe that public discussions, education, and critical analysis is actually the way to go and to take control of both the media environment and our lives. And I think having a lot of public discourse about these issues is the way to change things. We live in a media-saturated environment. I've got some numbers here that may be interesting to you. On a typical day, a young person is faced with a media environment that includes more than 200 cable television networks, 5,500 consumer magazine titles, 10,500 radio stations, and 30 million or more websites. Market research indicates that children and teenagers, in particular, are major media consumers. U.S. teens spend between $124 and $190 billion a year, a significant portion of which is spent on electronics and media. The media are a prevailing presence in the lives of contemporary youth. A 2005 Kaiser Family Foundation study found that 8 to 18-year-olds spend an average of 6.5 hours a day with media. And, you know, I could go on and on, but the more you study media use, you know, a lot of kids will just say, I don't watch TV or I don't pay attention to the media. But they do. But they do. They're in it constantly with Facebooking, social networking, you know, listening to music, looking at media, even watching television. They're still doing that. They're still going to movies. More and more and more we live in this really sort of just completely mediated world. There was even a story in this morning's USA Today that I got at my hotel that talked about little tiny kids, toddlers with iPhones and iPads and whatnot. So, you can't keep them away from it. They're in this kind of environment. And you can't keep kids in a bubble either. You can't shield them from it. You can't stop them from getting exposed to this kind of material. I think as a responsible parent, I try to monitor how much my children engage with media, what they watch, and so on. But when they leave the house, you know, they're fair game. There are billboards. They walk through a mall. There's Victoria's Secret, huge, you know, billboards everywhere. So it's not like you can keep them, you know, away from it. They're going to be getting it one way or another. So I think the best thing we can do is to start, you know, developing this kind of critique and helping them to become, you know, proactive consumers instead of just passive audiences for the media. I think we really have to take the media seriously as a cultural factor with enormous significance and impact, especially in the realm of gender and sexuality. And I don't think we can dismiss it as just background noise or meaningless or so on. I mean, if it was so meaningless, you know, it wouldn't be generating billions of dollars the way it does. You know, it wouldn't be so pervasive. It wouldn't be such a huge, huge part of contemporary life if nobody was paying any attention to it and if we were all just not influenced by it whatsoever. You know, I think all of us, in one way or another, you know, have to deal with this constantly. And so we really need to be thinking more seriously about how to cope with it. And, you know, of course, children are less well-equipped to deal with these things than we are. You know, they're cognitively, they're at a developmental stage where they're not as capable of kind of critical analysis or being able to distinguish between fact and fiction as easily as adults can. And so I think it's incumbent upon adults to try to help them to do that so that they, because it's things are getting, you know, I hate to say it, but things are getting worse in terms of the kinds of media are out there, the profit motives behind media, and the amount of media and the types of media that children are being exposed to at earlier and earlier ages. And so it's kind of becoming more and more imperative that we need to take proactive steps to help them to cope with this environment instead of just kind of, you know, ignoring it and throwing up our hands and saying, oh, what can you do? It's out there. You know, I think there's a lot we can do. So I want to end with two quotes that I found highly inspiring, actually, in my own work. The first is from the psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, who said, "In an ideal world, sexual decisions should be the result of intentional choices." And I really like this quote because, you know, the idea is that sexuality should not be coerced, it should not be forced, it should not be, you know, just because everybody else is doing it, right? It should be the result of a carefully thought through intentional choice, right? And I do like that. And the second one is from the feminist anthropologist Margaret Mead, who said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." So, you know, I think these may be ideals, but I think they're ideals well worth working toward. You know, I do think that if we set our minds to it, we can do our little bit to try to change the world in positive, progressive ways. So at this point, I'm really interested in your thoughts, your comments, any of the ideas you have, maybe after having read the book or, you know, had experience with some of these things yourselves. So, I mean, I'm sure you have a great deal to offer, too, and I always end up learning from the people that I speak to about these issues. So I'll stop here, and I would love to take questions, comments, or anything else from the crowd. Thank you. Okay, and Jeff's got a mic, I think, so.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Williams. I'm the director of the library here. Your book has been circulating very well.
Oh, thank you. Good to know.
One thing that disappointed me a little bit is that, and I know you can't address everything in a book aimed at a popular readership, was the complicity of the consumer. in this.
Oh, you're
for instance,
right.
That pretty baby's video. My first reaction was, what were their mothers thinking?
I know.
Because I doubt very much if their fathers bought those costumes and took them to practice. And I think perhaps you are letting the consumer off a little too easily in your book.
Well, okay, yeah, I appreciate that, and you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right that there's consumer complicity. But one of the reasons, actually, I wrote the book was to try to change that. I wrote it for parents, I wrote it for teachers, I wrote it for people who work with children so that they might actually, you know, become a little bit more aware of what's going on. So, you know, hopefully some of the suggestions I made were to try to change that. And I do agree that it's not the children who are buying these things for themselves, right? In the book, I also talk about things like they sell padded bras for seven-year-olds. They sell, the sexualizing products on the market for children are just, you know, unbelievable sometimes, and it's not the kids who are buying them. So, and I've talked to buyers in department stores who say those things just fly off the shelves, which is why they stock them. So I do think we need a lot more intervention, a lot more sort of consciousness raising, parent education, and so on about what the implications of some of these media and marketing campaigns are about. So I hope I'm not letting them off too easily. I was trying to actually reach out to them by writing this book.
I have a question about the title or in the front cover of the book. You chose a Caucasian young teen, and I wanted to ask you why.
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. The book, the cover gave me fits, actually, and I didn't choose it. It was my publisher. They had a graphic artist who designed the cover who came up with different options, and some of the first ones were just, I couldn't accept them because they were so objectifying. I mean, they sexualized the girls in ways that it was just doing what I was criticizing, so I couldn't do that. They came up with this image, and in the end, we settled on it. You're right, it's a Caucasian girl, a blonde girl, but in a way she epitomizes what I'm talking about. She is the Lolita effect, right? I mean, she is the construction that I'm talking about. So she represents the exact thing that I'm speaking about, the type of image that's being circulated as ideal. So in the end, that's why I thought this one worked. Also, it showed her face, it showed her eyes, it didn't objectify her by cutting off her face and only showing her body, and those were issues for me. So that's why I ended up with that cover.
I know that someone already mentioned letting the consumer off too easy, and I guess my concern was I felt like the book let parents off too easy. Mm-hmm. Why are our children spending so much time in front of the TV? Mm-hmm. Why are they, you know, searching the internet and not being supervised? And I know that there were suggestions of ways that parents could talk to their children, but I think that parents really need to stand up and take responsibility.
I agree. I mean, I do agree. I mean, ultimately, parents need to be, you know, completely thoughtful about, I mean, we need more and more parental consciousness right now because things are getting a little, you know, sort of worse and worse every day in terms of what's being, what's being circulated in the media and the access to media that children have. 75% of American children have televisions in their room and no supervision. You know, it's the same thing with internet access now. Today's article in USA Today was very clear that they're on their parents' iPads and iPhones and no one's really watching them every minute. There are some real problems there. As I said, I did try to reach out to parents by writing the book. That's why I wrote it for a general audience. But the other thing that I am very much in favor of, I think it does take a village to raise a child, right? And I think often children are not getting these messages at home, which is why I think schools ought to be very much involved in this, that there should be, for example, you know, maybe PTA-led or after-school workshops where kids can talk about these kinds of issues. I think the type of sex ed that happens in schools has to go beyond just the pure biology of it and talk more about even the media. I mean, I push very hard in the book for media literacy to be part of the K-12 curriculum in our schools today because I think it's just as important now as writing or arithmetic or anything. I think we have to have media literacy as a required part of the curriculum so that kids start to recognize the profit motives behind the media, the digital imaging techniques that are used to produce these kinds of images. So I think schools ought to play a role, and I think there are a lot of other faith-based organizations, churches. I mean, I've spoken in all of these kinds of organizations where a lot of adults are taking responsibility to try to help combat some of this. So I think it can happen in lots of places. And if the parents aren't doing the job, then we can do it in other places.
Obviously, this issue isn't new. It's been around at least since the 70s. I mean, I've been reading articles like this for years. It's probably more prevalent. But recently, a report came out that more than 50% of the students entering higher education are women.
Mm-hmm.
So they're clearly getting another message as well in that they can be academically and intellectually successful. So do you see, I mean, there's like a dichotomy here. Can you speak to the different messages women are getting and if you see, you know, sort of a future trends coming up?
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by that number, that 50% of college enrollment is female right now, and also that women are making huge gains in medical school and law schools, right? So to me, okay, part of this is a result of the consciousness of the 1970s. I mean, of the feminist activism in the 70s, but then in the 90s, when Mary Pfeiffer and others started realizing the really negative culture for girls that was happening, and that started to turn around. So it was, so now it's about 15 years or so since that movement happened, and I think that's where we're seeing, you know, so it was the recognition and the activism around that actually, I think, sparked some of the gains that we're seeing. But I do think that there's other things going on, that the more gains women are making in the world, the more women are entering higher education, the more women are making their voices felt in the world, the more we're seeing this kind of backlash where we're seeing, you know, Paris Hilton on the cover of 17. We're not seeing young scientists, young writers, young architects. You'd never see that on the cover of a teen magazine. So there's a real, you know, there's a backlash happening against it in the media environment. And so I think it's very complicated. There was a recent study of high school students in the Boston area who said that they felt like they had to do everything. They had to be super intelligent. They had to be hot. They had to be desirable. They had to have perfect bodies. They had to excel in every sphere. And that's putting a lot of pressure on young women now, too. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on as well.
All right, one last question.
You had mentioned that parents should talk to their children about the actual sex talk at an earlier age. At what age did you talk to your girls about it and describe your experience?
Okay, so we've had conversations on and off about this with my own kids. And the first was, I have two daughters, so when I was pregnant with the second one, the older one was three. And she said, you know, how did that baby get in your tummy? So I kind of gave her the basics, you know, very biological, kind of clinical, you know, the daddy has, you know, whatever, the sperm, and the mommy has ovaries, an egg, and, you know, whatever, it made a baby. And then she said, but no, how did the sperm get into your body? So, like, I was thinking, I said, so she was three. I said, okay, I'll tell you when you're a little bit older. Because she was three. I just didn't think she needed to know the whole deal about sex when she was 3 years old. So as they get a little bit older, they ask more questions, I try to answer them as honestly as I can. And I try to decide what's appropriate for them at that moment. Now my older daughter is 12, and we're having sort of more open discussions about, you know, about sexuality, about boys, about, you know, even about, you know, preventing pregnancies and things like that. So, I think it has to be an ongoing kind of thing, but I opened it up very early with them, and they were asking the questions, and I tried to be, you know, I tried to be honest, but also age-appropriate. You know, I tried to be conscious of their developmental level. So I don't know that there's a perfect age where any of this has to start. I think people know their kids, teachers know their students, and that you just try to handle it as responsibly as you can so that they don't get misinformation.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Meenakshi Jiji Durham, Associate Professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Iowa, and author of The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, November 8, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Carmen Steele, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture event at College of St. Mary will be the annual Great Conversations Luncheon, which will be held Thursday, March 24th at 11:30 a.m. in the Mercy Hall Meeting Room. This year's speaker will be Ilana Stanger Ross, author of SEMA's Undergarments for Women. For information about tickets, call Chrissy Valipek at 402-399-2330 or go online at csm.edu/events. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.